This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Todd Machover is a cellist, composer, and high-tech inventor who believes passionately that technology can democratize music. He's widely recognized as one of the most innovative composers of his generation. Right now, we're listening to music from his latest CD, which is called But Not Simpler.
Machover is a professor of music and media at MIT's Media Lab. Beyond his composing, he's famous for his inventions, including HyperScore and Hyper Instruments, which make it possible for just about anyone to compose and play music, and which led to the development of the wildly popular Guitar Hero. He's a proponent of the positive effects of making music, which we'll be hearing about more in a minute.
Todd Machover is the first artist we're featuring as part of WBUR's new series, Boston Visionaries, which is profiling men and women from Greater Boston who have earned acclaim for the work they do and the success they've achieved. He's here in our studio now to answer your questions about the intersection of music and technology and about the benefits of making music. But first, this profile from WBUR's Bianca Vazquez-Tonis.
Todd Machover became famous 20 years ago for inventing hyper instruments. Hyper as in hypersensitive hybrids combining instruments with computers. Here's Matt Heimovitz performing Machover's Begin Again Again on the hypercello. World-famous cellist Yo-Yo Ma debuted this piece at Tanglewood in 1991. Instead of playing just one melodic line, the hypercellist can play melody and a full accompaniment. As Machover says,
it's somewhere in between being kind of a performer and a composer and a conductor. What comes out can be beyond what I can usually play with two hands.
A New York Times critic called Yo-Yo Ma's bionic performance brilliantly annoying and fascinating.
Like a lot of things I do, it was controversial, and definitely some people felt, oh my gosh, how could you do this to an acoustic cello, or, you know, Yo-Yo's got a thing on his wrist.
This urge to shake up musical performances still drives much of what Machover does. The 58-year-old runs a program at MIT called Opera of the Future. That's really what it's called. The group tries to advance the way people make and experience music. Machover was born for this job. At 13, he became obsessed with how music is made after hearing the Beatles album, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band.
Here was this incredible album that had so many layers of sound, and it was every little bit was mixed in the studio where you could take all the time you needed to get it just right. And it was the first album the Beatles did that was consciously designed not to be played live.
As more and more music is produced this way, Machover says people have become alienated from music because people don't learn how to play like they used to.
If you don't make music yourself, it's very hard to have the full pleasure and the full power of listening to it. The connection isn't the same.
So he invented toys that could help kids explore musical concepts without knowing the technical stuff. Then he and grad students in his lab designed a computer program called HyperScore. HyperScore is an easy-to-use computer software program using lines and colors to compose music. You don't have to know the rules of music theory or notation.
You just have to start. And with a little bit of guidance, you can make incredibly sophisticated things and learn to make them better and better.
Machover recognized the positive effects of making music, improving cognition, decreasing stress, and boosting self-esteem. In 2004, Tewksbury Hospital, a public facility providing long-term care for mentally ill and disabled patients, invited Machover to teach HyperScore. Hundreds came to hear his presentation.
They all had something they wanted to express. They were just bursting with, you know, I love the guitar and I love Spanish music. Could I use this to write a song? Could I write something where my sister's voice could be accompanied by a HyperScore piece? I mean, I just couldn't believe it.
Hi, my name is Dan. We met Todd in 04. My occupational therapist tasked me to join the HyperScore group.
37-year-old Dan Elsie was born with cerebral palsy and has lived at Tewksbury Hospital for 14 years. He can't speak or walk, but using a sensor Machover and his students made for his forehead, Elsie composes and conducts using HyperScore. This song is from his latest CD.
Hey, After I met with Todd, I felt like I'm a musician now. I can help the people and teach them how to use the HyperScore.
Dan Elzey ending that report from WBUR's Bianca Vasquez-Tonis about Todd Macover. And joining us now is Todd Macover. He's a cellist, composer, inventor, and professor of music and media at the MIT Media Lab. And Todd Macover, what a pleasure to have you on Radio Boston. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks so much, Anthony. Great to be here.
So listeners, you can join the conversation with Todd Macover. What do you make of his mission to democratize music making? What questions do you have about the intersection of music and technology? How will this change music in, say, 10 years, 20 years, 40 years? Give us a call at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. And Todd, I'd love to start where that profile ended with Dan Elzey, who has cerebral palsy, who lives at Tewksbury Hospital. And by the way, for our listeners, there's a sort of moving video of him demonstrating his piece, which he composed with HyperScore, which you designed, Todd, invented. But watching his reaction to the music is amazing, and it seems to animate him. And I'm just wondering if you can talk about how people like Dan can be helped by music.
Well, I think music is one of the deepest activities we have. It's so interesting because when we hear a piece of music, it seems to get to us physically. It just affects us very deeply. At the same time, research shows that music actually uses more parts of our brain than any other activity. It seems to use emotional centers and speech centers and story centers, and seems to connect all these parts. So it really involves us kind of completely. And that's one of the reasons why over the years I've felt that the more actively one can participate in music, the deeper your reaction is going to be. So I started out just by making music, and then started out by and then tried to bring music to kids so that it became more fun and more immediate to be involved in music. Then it's fine to study 20 years of piano. In fact, I recommend it. Mm-hmm. But while you're studying the 20 years, it's great to be doing exciting, creative things. And then we realized that the reaction from kids was so positive that we thought that there must be many, many other people in the world who, first of all, were really interested in expressing themselves and communicating musically, and also would benefit from it. So that's when we started working at Tewksbury, and we found, in fact, that if you can provide the right tool, if you can provide an environment that makes it natural and intuitive and easy for people to make music, shape music, touch music, that there's kind of no limit to who wants to participate.
And so that brings us to HyperScore, and I want to ask you about that. But first, one more question about Tewksbury and Dan Elzey. I mean, when you see the video of him playing, there's clearly joy on his face, but the music is doing more than that, isn't it? I mean, it can really sort of alter pathologies. It can make people actually better, right?
That's right, and we're learning more and more about this all the time. But since music activates so many of our mental and physical systems, the list is very, very long. We know that Parkinson's patients whose minds become very confused and often can't walk, all of a sudden their mobility is activated when they hear synchronized music. So,
fascinating.
So it helps you walk. People who've had strokes and lose the ability to speak, music is usually the best way. You could find people who can't say a word, but they can actually sing a song they know mm-hmm. with the words. And so there's actually a fantastic therapy developed by Gottfried Schlag at Harvard that uses singing melodies with very rhythmic words to retrain speech. And memory is the big, remarkable connection. Memory seems to be embedded in us more deeply when we have a strong musical experience. Music brings back our memories. Music is the last thing that Alzheimer's patients still respond to. You can find somebody who's can't recognize themselves in a mirror, can't recognize their family. But if you find a shard of music that they're familiar with, usually from a long time ago, the person will become themselves again. They'll stand up, they'll sing the music, they'll become alive. And we're trying to find out how to prolong that effect and also how to use music to diagnose something like, are you starting to have memory problems before we can detect that any other way?
Fascinating. And I want to talk to you more about what you're doing with music in the health context. But first, I want to urge listeners to join this conversation with Todd Machover. He's part of our Visionary series here at WBUR, Boston Visionary Series. What do you make of his mission to use music to make people better? The democratization of music making is one of the big themes here as well. Give us a call at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Todd, tell us a little bit more about HyperScore. This was the technology that you invented. It was the springboard for the very popular computer music game Guitar Hero. But what is it exactly? How does it work?
So HyperScore is a piece of software, and it was developed in my group at the MIT Media Lab, and came out of a project called Toy Symphony, where we wanted to have children fall in love with music first and then demand music lessons from their parents after, rather than the reverse. So we made a whole series of music toys that you could squeeze music out of music shapers, play little beat bug, little music insects to make rhythms. And HyperScore, we wanted to let anybody compose original music. So it's just software. It uses lines and color on a screen. You don't need to know music notation. You don't need to know the rules of music. And by drawing these lines and colors, you can start with very simple music and build up things which are quite remarkable. So, for instance, we just got back from Armenia, where we ran a program with the Armenian government and the U.S. Embassy and invited children to write pieces with HyperScore, both for the National Symphony in Armenia and also for rock band, a real rock band, Dogma.
Well, in fact, we've got a little bit of tape. Let's just play a little bit of this. Here's some of the song Dream. This is by 9-year-old Armin Shevardian, who's never composed before. He wrote this piece with HyperScore for his rock band Dogma. Okay, so there's just a little taste of it. So tell us about that piece of music.
So this was really interesting because my team and I at the Media Lab were here in Cambridge, and there were a group of quite a large number of children in Armenia in four different sites around the country working with HyperScore. A couple of people from Armenia came over to MIT to spend a couple of days to learn HyperScore, and then they went back. And these children in Armenia made their pieces with HyperScore. We'd check in with them once in a while to give them some advice, but basically they followed their own intuitions. There were a group of children here in the Boston area also writing music with HyperScore. We had a big Skype session where they got together and wrote a piece together for symphony orchestra. And this piece for Dogma, Dogma is actually not Armin, the 9-year-old's rock band, but it's the most famous rock band in Armenia.
Oh, I see. So he actually wrote it for them.
That's right.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
And this rock band, it's what happens always, either with, whenever we work with non-professionals and invite them to write with HyperScore, at first the professional musicians kind of look at this as, well, that's kind of a cute thing to do. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll try. But then when they see the music, it happened with the orchestra there and it happened with this rock band, they just light up with joy because they realize that these kids have written amazing pieces, and that it's kind of connection between experts and virtuosi and the general public and kids and general audiences that we lose more and more in music. It's just what makes a healthy music culture.
Well, let me ask you about the controversial part. I mean, the idea that we can create technology that gives us this shortcut to musical ability. What about the purists who say this isn't the way to learn music?
Well, I think that the way to learn anything is to have an incredible motivation to accomplish and produce something that you really care about. That's why most of us learn, whether it's a language or math. If you don't have a reason that you really want to do it,
right,
you're probably not going to learn it. So the problem with a lot of music learning is that the goal is of being able to truly express yourself is so far off that many people just get lost along the way.
Right.
And also, I mean, we were talking, Anthony, you and I were talking right before we went on air. You were saying something which I heard all the time, which is that What
I revealed to you is I love music, and at the ripe sort of age of mid-40s or something, I said, I'm going to learn to play the piano, and I sort of embarked on that mission. And it's hard, and it's frustrating, and I don't have the patience, but probably don't have the time to really go back and learn the basics. So I've sort of plateaued very quickly.
Well, I'll challenge you, and my belief is that if somebody loves listening to music,
yeah,
by definition, you know more about music than you think you do. Mm-hmm. So I think if music stirs something in you, then there's a path for everybody to have a deeper understanding and a deeper ability. And really what I think about technology is that it's the great malleable, shapeable tool it's kind of a bridge between where each of us is and where we want to get. And if you can shape the technology to reach out to somebody, whether it's to a virtuoso or whether it's to, you know, a music lover like yourself or to a child or to somebody with a medical problem, the technology can value what you're pretty good at and help you with the things you're not good at.
And you make an important distinction. I mean, it's great to appreciate and love music, but you place special value on making music yourself, right? I mean, there's a real important sort of added value with that ability.
I think that's right. I think getting inside any activity makes it more yours. And music in particular, you know, 100 years ago, 150 years ago, when there was no radio and no CDs and no iPods, we experience music by singing together in a religious service, or by a new song would come out, whether it was a song by Schubert or a song by a popular composer, and you'd gather around the piano on a Saturday evening with the sheet music and do your best to sing it. And we've lost that completely over the way, because part of technology does a lot of this for us, the iPod and all of our music.
But see, here's the thing that I'm a little confused about, and I want you to explain it, because we heard in Bianca's piece where you were first sort of struck by this idea with a great Beatles record, Sgt. Pepper's, and Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, and this was the first record that was produced in a studio with no intention of it being played, right? And there, it seems like there's more and more and more of that music. So doesn't that sort of pull us further away from this idea of performing music when so much technology is involved?
It does, but that's exactly what I see my mission as being, which is, how do you have the best of both worlds?
I see.
So when I heard that Sgt. Pepper's when I was 12 or whatever, first of all, musically a light bulb went off. It was like, you know, this gorgeous sound, and the melodies were perfect, and also the complexity, so many layers. And I had the first big argument with my mom, who was my music teacher, because she didn't like it. And I said, no, this is great music.
Oh, she didn't like it. How interesting.
No. She really didn't.
Because she was a classically trained musician.
Yes, completely.
Right. Yeah.
But anyway, I thought, yes, the part of this where you can create it very, very carefully in the studio leads to a kind of beauty that you can't have any other way. But it also takes away from the fact that music is meant to be shared spontaneously and is meant to be, you know, between people you're jamming with or an audience. And so I thought, how could you do both? How could you have that beauty and complexity and also have the physicality and the ability to change on the spot? So that's what a hyper instrument is. That's what all of this work allows us to do.
Listeners, we're talking with Todd Macover. He's a professor of media and music at the MIT Media Lab. He's also the subject of our Boston Visionary series. You can join the conversation about music and technology, the intersection of music and technology. We're also going to be talking about how music will change, say, in 20 years, 40 years with this technology. We're at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. Let's take a call from Katie, who's calling from Burlington. Hi, Katie.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I wanted to ask Todd a question. I'm a music teacher in the Boston area, and I think what you're doing, especially with HyperScore, is really inspiring and valuable, and it sounds like something I would love to use in the classroom. But my specialty is voice, and I was wondering if you, down the road, were thinking of incorporating some kind of technology that could incorporate singing, as you were talking about earlier.
Thanks so much, Katie. That's a great question.
Thanks, Katie.
So it just so happens, I agree with you that voice, for every reason, is kind of the magic instrument. You know, it's, if we all have a voice, and even if we haven't been trained as singers, we probably are pretty good at singing along, and our voice expresses who we are personally. And it's kind of funny, because even though we grow up with our voices, a lot of people are actually a little intimidated to use their voices. So we're working at a project actually with one of my grad students at the Media Lab named Ellie Jessup, who's a special, typical of people at the Media Lab. She has an incredible mixed background. She studied, before coming to MIT, she studied computer science and conducting and choreography and choral conducting in particular. So we're working together on a kind of hyper instrument for the voice designed for the general public, a way to invite people to sing in groups and to match their voices and actually to use singing almost to meditate. And it's funny because when we did the project in Armenia that I was talking about before, and we'd Skype with all these kids in Armenia who were making Hyperscore pieces, and then a couple of days we had a group of kids in our lab at MIT connected by Skype to kids in Armenia. The way that we made our Hyperscore pieces was by having everybody sing what they wanted to do, because it was too slow to work with a mouse and a keyboard. So we'd stand there and I'd say, okay, how do we start this piece? Who has a good melody? And someone would go, la, 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 lum. And then we'd put it into Hyperscore and say, is that what you want? Oh, not exactly. Great, that's it. And each of the melodies and each of the, we tap out the rhythms. So Hyperscore doesn't do that yet, but it's one of our goals that within the next year, we'll have probably a couple of different ways to allow people to use their voices, to be creative, to plug into Hyperscore and to do other things.
Well, that's a great question, Katie. Thanks for that. In fact, it answers one of the questions that I wanted to ask you, Todd, sort of where is this all going 10 years, 20 years from now? I'm going to hold that question for a little later in the interview.
Good, though. I can think of an answer then.
Let's go to Rob, who's calling from the Back Bay. Hi, Rob.
Hi, how you doing?
Very well.
Good. Just had a question about, I guess, the current use of Hyperscore in with musicians. You know, are they using it to record and produce music now? You know, in a position or other than kind of regular people, if you're familiar with like Beta Fleck and the Flecktones, is Future Man's, you know, Drumtar 3000 an example of that, or other stuff kind of going on? And I can take my response off the air.
Thanks, Rob.
Thanks, Rob. Yeah, good question. Hyperscore is unusual because we really designed it for non-expert musicians. I mean, I actually am interested in tools that combine people, you know, that are useful to people of all levels of musicianship. I would say Hyperscore is best for people who have no music background or some music background. It's not ideal if you have a lot of music background, partly because it's a great environment to experiment in and to build up things from little parts, which is what people, it's a great way to get people started who don't have a lot of experience. Somebody like myself, usually when I start a composition, I think like a lot of my colleagues, either I start because I have an instrument at my fingers, for me it's the cello, and years of experience kind of let my fingers go and take me somewhere, or I let my imagination go and think of something the way it sounds, and then I want a tool to realize that as quickly as possible. Hyperscore is not ideal. The stronger idea you have when you start, you might want another tool. But I don't know if we have queued up a piece called Winding Line. We might not.
I don't believe we do.
Anyway, once in a while, I use Hyperscore, and a lot of my colleagues use Hyperscore to make a particular piece on my new CD, but not simpler. There are three pieces called...
Todd, I am told we do have it. So this is Winding Line.
So this is something I actually made with Hyperscore to test it out.
Very nice. So that's with Hyperscore.
Yeah,
right.
So it can be done. You can do all kinds of things with it.
But now, as someone who is a classically trained musician like yourself, are you limited by Hyperscore?
I think the way Hyperscore is now, it's not the ideal tool for somebody who's incredibly skilled and has a lot of experience. So one of the ways that we're pushing it is actually to make it more useful for people with a lot of experience. And another way we're pushing it is, what would it be like to have a tool like this to make not just music, but to make music that also has a story and also has image and also has video? So we're working on something called personal opera to allow people to tell their stories with a kind of drawing sketch language. Peter Torpe and my group at MIT is working on that very hard right now.
Fascinating. Let's take a call from John, who's calling from Andover. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Well, thank you very much for taking my call.
Very happy to have you.
Hi, John.
The first job I ever had was at ARP Instruments, and ARP, of course, made synthesizers. But while I was there, I also got to hear a lot of experimental instruments, like an Emmett Chapman stick. And I was wondering if you're looking at, like, expanding what music sounds like. I mean, you can make new instruments that have never been heard before. And is there any facility for doing that kind of experimentation?
Absolutely. I think maybe what drives me and I think a lot of my colleagues at the end of the day is to create musical experiences, not just that are new for the sake of being new, but that give us a different psychological, emotional experience when we hear them. So I think the goal of this is to push music itself into the future. So we do that all the time. And personally, I am always attracted to instruments and sounds and musical worlds that are modeled after the physical world and the acoustic world, are not purely electronic and are not purely acoustic, but are some kind of hybrid. You know, the electronic world allows us to take anything out of our imagination and make it real. The physical world, the natural world, probably gives us some pretty good cues about what human beings find moving and meaningful. So I always like to combine the two. And yeah, all the instruments we make are not just designed to play differently, but also to sound differently.
John, thanks so much for that call. Todd, let me ask you about this. With this idea, the sort of concept embedded in HyperScore of people making music themselves, more people making the music themselves, what happens to the sort of traditional role of musician and audience?
I think it's changing. Mm. And I think for many, many reasons. One reason that we've discussed already is I think it's very important that there's a creative and active dialogue between people making music and people listening to music. It's a lot of the problems that we find in our culture right now are there's certain experts who make things and many, many people who kind of passively sit around as spectators. The healthiest culture is one where everybody has skin in the game. Mm. So just to make things lively, we want everybody participating. But more than that, I think that we've talked before about music that brings children in to become creative, music that might connect with people with various medical or physical, mental limitations. The more work that we do like that, the more it becomes clear that for music to be effective, for one of these instruments that I design to be effective, it actually has to be as customized as possible for a particular person. So if I'm making an instrument for Dan Elsie at Tewksbury, mm-hmm. or if I'm designing an experience for a particular child, or if I'm making an experiment for somebody who has early onset Alzheimer's, each person's need is quite different. Their physical ability is different. The way they're going to react to the music is different. So I think that one of the major things that's going to happen is that music will little by little be customized for particular people in particular situations. I think of it as personal music.
So a piece of music is no longer a sort of a piece of static art that you listen to again and again in the same way, right?
I think there'll always be a place for that because there's certain parts of us that actually like to hear the same thing over and over. But I think there's a growing field that's just starting where that's exactly right, that you can think of a piece of music as a kind of organic system that's like a collaboration between the person who made it and the person who's listening to it. And I think, we're starting to make things like this. I think this field will blossom where the piece of music will come to you as the listener in a form that it might, every time you push the playlist, it might simply play differently. It might have a different ending, but I might squeeze something or touch something or use my voice, and that'll make the music play out differently each time. And the person, the composer who sends it to me or the performer, might also be a kind of doctor or a psychologist and actually shapes that music because of what would be most powerful for me right now.
Fascinating. Let's see if we can squeeze one more call in here. Jason is calling from Newton. Hi, Jason.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was actually wondering about archaeology. I'm really interested in sort of ancient music and like the speculation around like maybe old systems of notation, or like with Lears and Catharas. And I discovered a guy named Michael Levy recently who has like really fascinating music that he plays on replicas of ancient biblical lyres and Greek lyres and instruments like that. And I wonder if there's any way that this technology could be applied in a way towards, well, I don't know if you'd call it archaeomusicology, to maybe speculate about the way music used to sound and maybe try to recapture something going as far back as maybe even Sappho.
Yeah, so could this technology help us understand what that ancient music sounds like, right?
I know a certain amount about the experimentation even further back. So there's some very interesting people around the world. I have a couple of colleagues at Oxford University who are working on the origins of music. So even before the Greeks, even, you know, there's a lot of questions, number one, about what came first, singing or speech. There's a friend of mine who's a professor at Oxford who for the last 5 or 6 summers has gone out with a team of archaeologists, and they actually bang on rocks in a variety of different ways. And what they're trying to do is to think about whether tool making came first, that early primitive humans made tools, and in making the tools and in sharpening them, the rhythm of the tools all of a sudden triggered a kind of response of, hey, gee, that sounds really cool, let's create a drum section. Or if kind of the opposite happened, if people had this incredible desire to communicate, maybe over a distance or to make sounds, and banged on rocks to make sound, and all of a sudden said, oh my God, I've been banging on this enough that it's sharp, and gee, I can, you know, I don't like his music, so I'm going to stab him or something. And the speculation is that depending on the patterns of wear and tear in the rock, it would indicate one or the other. So I know about that work. I don't know too much about reconstructing biblical music systems because I just personally don't know what's left and what isn't or how technology can help, but we could give it a try.
Jason, it's a great question. And Todd, it's been great talking to you. Before I let you go, I just want to mention that this Thursday you actually have a new play opening. You composed the music. It's called Remembering HM. Now, where's this play going to be opening?
Yeah, so this is unusual. It's the first time I've ever written music for a play. The play itself is called Yesterday Happened, Remembering HM. It's written by Wesley Savick, and it's at the Central Square Theater in Cambridge. And it's very interesting. The play is about a guy named Henry Molaison who had an operation in the early 50s to cure his epilepsy. And oops, instead of curing epilepsy, they took out his memory. First time that had ever happened. So he became the central subject for studying what memory is and how it works. This play is about our relationship to memory and what this man's life was like and how he was studied. And I tried to make a musical score to show how music affects our memories deeply and what happens when it's on the edge of remembering or not remembering.
So that's Remember HM at Central Square Theater. That's opening on Thursday. The musical score by Todd Machover, who's been our guest musical innovator. He's a professor of music and media at the MIT Lab and director of the lab's Hyper Instruments and Opera of the Future groups. Todd Machover, what a pleasure. Thank you for coming in. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Anthony.
And Todd Machover is the first in our series of Boston Visionaries. You can find a video of him and a detailed timeline of his life and achievements at our website, radioboston.org. Next up in the series are Clara and William Wainwright, and we'll go out on Todd Machover's winding line from his album But Not Simpler. Stay with us. Coming up, new developments in a child pornography crackdown across the state. I'm Anthony Brooks with Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.